Welcome to my 200th episode. Yes, 200. I can't quite believe it myself. I can, though, hand on heart, say that this podcast has been, personally, one of the greatest gifts to my life. It's genuinely been an MBA for me, and I've learned and I continue to learn something new every week. And I so hope that if you're listening to this, it's been the same for you. They say that one key to happiness is curiosity. And this podcast has stirred a curiosity in me bigger than I ever knew, I ever dreamt possible. And so I can safely say that being here with you today, I am the happiest in my life. I do hope this podcast has had an impact in your life, as I said, and your journey too. I know the road can be tough and lonely at times, and my greatest hope is that each one of my guests has in some way given you a small or large beacon of light, a glimmer of excitement, a massive dollop of hope, even more drive or reassurance that you are far from alone. That you are, in fact, part of a collective, a group of brilliantly brave human beings who believe in their dreams, take a path less trodden, and seek a life of curiosity and adventure. That's how I dream of my listeners. So when it came to my 200th episode, you can imagine there was much discussion in the office about what it should be. But it was after my conversation with Helen Pankhurst a few weeks ago, alongside the backdrop of politics at a fever pitch, with big promises and new futures reimagined for the UK, I had an idea. Nearly every time I finish an interview with a guest, I feel this longing for their views to be heard by all of the UK, that their actual words were listened to by those in charge. I wish there was a new party founded by founders, basically because their ability to go up against the grain, to think differently, their natural society's problem solvers, they have depth of knowledge in their fields, they care about society, they care about the environment. I think it makes them the perfect candidates to create a new movement. That even if they didn't have their own party, I hope that whoever gets into power this July should harness the sheer force of these amazing business people who have created careers and or businesses through their vision for a better future, alongside the normal measures for success that we all know about in business. So in this episode, I want to explore what the future would look like if the most brilliant minds and founders, those who truly are experts, they've walked the walk, not just talked the talk, were spearheading the policies of our country. How would they reshape our world with their boundless creativity and relentless drive for improvement? Well, let's find out, shall we?
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to my podcast, Conversations of Inspiration. I've reached out to founders and those who simply inspire me to share their hard-earned wisdom with you. My hope is that collectively, these remarkable realizations will help you on your own journey. I like to think of it as inspiration for life. So let's begin this week's conversation of inspiration. I thought we'd kick off with a rallying cry from Sir Tim Smith, profound, extremely clever visionary, and he's fun. He's the perfect guest to get us started.
I have always believed that the way to create wonderful things is to imagine what it looks like when it's finished. And then work backwards to work out what I must have done in order to get there. Because I've noticed an awful lot of people who have dreams then become casual about it and they just follow their noses. And by the time they get halfway there, the dream has been modified to become something I'd be rather ashamed of as having a dream. You know what I mean? It becomes...
Yes, watered down and fitted into boxes and Excel spreadsheets.
Well, yes, but also... A real dream, if you're working at scale, a dream has got to be populist in the sense that you've created a, you used the word mythology, but you've created a stage on which many, many people can see their lives playing out. The secret of a great adventure is that it mustn't be your great adventure alone. It must leave space for the spotlight to land on lots and lots of people. You must also distrust people who say, let's do this for the young. Let's do this for our children and our children's children. I really don't like people who do that, because I've found in my life that most people who say, let's do this for our children and our children's children, are people who just don't want to be of action and do it now. Do it for you. Do it now. Also, this whole youth stuff, youth is suffering so much. Yes, it is. It has always suffered. It has suffered probably since about 15,000 BC. Every generation has said the children suffer so much. We put our hopes in children. When I walk around in the areas we've got projects, we've got 17 projects around the world. What kind of dog's that?
Oh, God. I mean, Tim, this has all never happened. Just one second. That's
a border. I love borders. Love borders.
Embarrassed.
No, don't be embarrassed. That's
bloody recording. I'm just so embarrassed. Never has this ever happened. I normally just have a plain sailing time, but you're so magnetic. You're drawing Mercury forces here. It's, I never trust anybody that says, let's do it for the young.
I never trust anybody who says, let's do it for the young and for our children and our children's children. Do it for you. Do it now. It's got an immediacy. The issue for our culture is that we have become a culture that has fallen in love with the anticipation of nice things in the future and the inability of appreciating the absolute joyous explosion of enjoying now, this moment, the coffee you are drinking, the person you are currently talking to, the flower you are looking at. Why is it that the silver embossed invitations to go to a party, which of course I hasten to say arrive rarely in these parts, but why is it that those parties, by very definition, are going to disappoint you? You know they will disappoint you because they cannot live up to your expectation. You will savour what might happen on that day, and you get there and you'll be one of several people, and it will be dull as ditch water as everybody does their sort of masquerade of the great and the good. I think the most powerful force in the world is the force of the middle-aged disenfranchised whose hopes are behind them, who've lost the belief in the person they were when they were 19. If you can fire them up, if you can put a little bit of WD-40 into their carburettors, if that isn't a mixed metaphor, your listenership, if they've got this far, saying, the man knows nothing about cars, that would actually stop the car dead. No. I tell you
that's
what,
all right. You know a bit about other things.
Yeah, well, you see, the really amazing thing I've discovered both at Ligon and at Eden is if you can take people over the age of 50 and tell them that the dreams of the person they were when they were 19 could come alive, this is the moment, this is the stage, you see those people come alive, you watch their shoulders go back a bit, and they would walk through coals with you. And that's how it is. And you know what? That passion rekindled in those people makes them the ideal mentors for the young people you then bring onto the project. And you see them bonding all over the place. That's why I often talk about a gang culture in a good sense. And people always say, oh, Tim, you shouldn't use the word gang. And I hate it. Why should other people populate a word which used to be nice and is now horrible because it's in crime with crime and viciousness? Let's call it a group.
A group, yes.
Fired. And I think when we look around our country, you're looking at, out of 68 million people, I bet you there are 30 million in this country waiting for the fire to be lit under the person they once thought they could be. And the problem is we're so ill-served by politicians who have no vision, who are working, it's a cliche to say they work in the short term. I'm not even sure many of them would be capable of doing better if they had a long term. But the thing is that no one is saying to us, I have a dream of the Britain we could become. I was a pro-Remainer, right? I was a pro-Remainer. And then the TV interviewed me about, you know, why I was a Remainer. And it was the usual cliche-ridden debate where everybody trotted out their arguments and wasn't listening to anybody. And then they came back 2 years later and they said, what do you make of this Remain debate? I said, I'm so bored. I'm bored by you. I'm bored by the place. You just have never dared to ask the right question. It was ITV and they said, well, what's the right question? I said, there is only one question. The question you should have been asking people like me is, what would it take to make you become a Brexiteer? That is the question.
Yes.
And the woman looked at me as if I'd slapped her with a cod. And I said, why don't you dare to ask me the question? And she said, what would it have taken to have made you, a publicly argumentative Remainer, be a Brexiteer? And I said, it's really simple. If someone had said we would slash various budgets, we would put it into the biggest investment in education our nation has ever seen.
Yes.
If you said to me, as an island, we believe that with the information of history, we should not be dependent for anything which is vital for our survival from outside our shores, and therefore we ought to become food independent and energy independent. I'm yours. I'll vote for you.
Gosh, yes.
Why do people ask the wrong question? I mean, it's crazy. Of course I didn't want to leave Europe because I love the fact that we are Europeans and the cultural things are fantastic. But the idea that this then becomes part of my tribal plumage is ridiculous. It's only tribal because no one asked the right questions. Why can't people say things like that?
To this day, I pinch myself that I not only got to interview Sir Tim Smith, but now get to call him a friend. Although this interview was recorded at the end of 2020, the topics covered feel more relevant than ever. I love the idea of us as a collective being the fire starters, as Tim describes. So from one icon of the UK to another, newly damed Anya Hindmarsh, a bastion of sustainability in the fashion space, a place where it is so needed, a true creative thinker and founder of one of the most interesting brands out there, in my opinion. We know sustainability and climate is one of the leading issues we face, and yet it feels that this area, policies, has had very little airtime in recent weeks. I think it's right that we need to sound the alarm, and Anya has her unique approach to this.
I mean, it's been an amazing project. I mean, it's been amazing because I've learned so much. And I mean, it's been hard as well at times because it's, you know, it's a huge amount of R&D and it gets quite political when you sort of dig into the sphere, as you can imagine. But I mean, the initial project, I'm Not a Plastic Bag, had a very simple aim, which was to try and make people think twice about taking single-use plastics. It was about awareness. Mm-hmm. I mean, awareness it got. It was absolutely unbelievable. I mean, it really was. And you know, 80,000 people in the UK and then on and on around the world. I was locked up in a basement in Tokyo because they were scared for my safety, which seemed ridiculous. But it was, you know, it was of that sort of level of madness. And I think 30 people went to hospital in Taiwan because there was a stampede. It closed an entire shopping mall. So not proud of that. And we stopped it immediately after that. But it was an amazing vehicle for awareness and for debate around the subject. We did it. It made a difference. It really did make a difference. I mean, I think the numbers of single-use plastic bags, according to the British Retail Consortium, went from 9 point something billion to 6 point something billion in a year. Not, of course, just us, because lots of people then, you know, really got involved as well. But it really did spark a debate. So I felt super proud of that project. Really complicated to do, not easy at all, fraught with difficulty, and we learned along the way as well. But it was great. So we sort of went back to normal life and carried on doing what we do for our day jobs. But then in 2020, all those years later, that fabulous 2020 that we've all just experienced, I felt that. Well, there was something I'd heard that was rattling around my brain, which was when you throw something away, there is no away.
Wow.
It really is that scary thought that, you know, everyone, frankly, should go and see a landfill site. Every single child in the country should actually visit a landfill site to realise what we all do. I always remember thinking, if you were to throw something away that couldn't be recycled and you had to bury it in your own garden, you would soon become overwhelmed with plastic rubbish in your garden and it would be horrible and you would just stop taking it. But because we're so disconnected from a landfill site, we're not realising that those huge banks of plastic and stuff that's sitting, you know, being buried in the land is horrid. We should stop it immediately. So I wanted to revisit the project, but with a different aim, really. So it wasn't just about awareness anymore, clearly. It was about how can we keep in circulation the 8 billion tons of plastic that are currently on the planet? How can we actually not do what we're doing now, which is take something, buy something, use it for too short a period and then put it into landfill, then buy something else and use it for too short a period and put it into landfill? How can we actually take something that was about to go into landfill, stop it going to landfill, use it again, make it into something beautiful and keep it in circulation, hopefully being used again or sold on and reused, but just avoid the landfill. So we don't just amass all this stuff that we don't do with. So we spent 2 years developing this fabric, which was complicated to do because we wanted to make something really beautiful. And it was like a lovely cotton drill, but made out of plastic we recovered and that we broke down into little pellets and then we melted and we spun and we weave into fabric. And it behaved, in fact, so much like a cotton drill that we wanted to coat one side of it because it got dirty. So we wanted to coat it with a sort of a coating. But we managed to find the plastic they put between glass windscreens, which stops the glass shattering in cars, which is called PVB. And we managed to reclaim that, which would have gone to landfill. And to use that on the coating as the coating on one side of the bag. So it was an amazing project, really complicated to do.
Wow. Yeah.
And we called it I Am a Plastic Bag because, of course, it's made of plastic. But it's a beautiful thing. So it's how can you take waste and make it into something beautiful? Mm. And so we launched that, was it February now? February 2020. And to launch it, we felt to connect people to this thing in my head about all the rubbish in my garden that I would have to plant in my garden. We actually closed all of our stores in London. And we emptied them and we filled them with 90,000 used plastic bottles.
I love this.
Which is probably why I got COVID, I think, because we had to find a lot of plastic bottles. We were literally going up and down the Eurostar, putting them all into a bag and taking them. The whole company was challenged and charged with trying to find these bottles. And we managed to get 90,000, which was 8 minutes of landfill.
Oh, my goodness.
Just to give people a sense of scale. And it was really interesting. So we filled all of our London stores overnight with these bottles, which, you know, came up like water, like sort of tide line, almost up to the ceiling. Mm. And people were climbing over them to try and sort of, you know, get out the door and close the door and leave all the bottles in. I think it was part protest, if you like, and part almost art installation. But it served, I think, to connect people to how disgusting it is. And people were stopping and looking and taking photographs and were kind of shocked by it. So I think it was a lovely project to really connect people to this problem, saying, now we need to talk about circularity of materials. We can't carry on like this. Mm. And so, yeah, it's been really fascinating, honestly. And is, as you can tell, a real passion project and hilarious, yeah. Given that my dad was, I think, one of the first people or was the first person to invent the plastic flower pot. So it goes full circle.
Do you think this is the era of the circular economy? Do you think that the fashion brands need to evolve and adapt? Do you think that they're going to?
We have to. I mean, we have 10 years. Mm. We have 10 years. And I had a very frightening meeting with someone who's incredibly, you know, learned on this subject. And he said to me, and it was quite terrible. He said, you know, it's too late, don't you? He said, it's too late for your children. And I said, what do you mean? He said, we will not get to net zero. We will not keep the planet at the temperature we need to keep it at just by our actions on carbon. We also need to offset. We're already into the territory of it being almost too late. And, you know, whether that's right or not, I don't know. But this is someone who's incredibly learned and written lots of academic papers on the subject. It's really frightening, you know, and I mean, COVID is a walk in the park. This is something that, you know, if we suddenly have a planet that's too hot, and you know how it is in the summer when you're in the Middle East, I mean, it's uncomfortable. So everyone migrates further north where it's cooler. And of course, then you get overcrowding, you get flooding. It's really frightening. So I think we have to assume this is a very, very serious problem and to act on it. We've got apparently 10 years. If we can, you know, do the combination of offsetting and reducing our carbon, we might just have a chance of doing it. So it's for now. It's not, you know, it's not for fun.
As Anya said, it's for now. A sentiment echoed by Sir Tim. Both Tim and Anya shared this vision of truly connecting people to the issues we face. When I hear Anya's stats and information, when we know we have 10 years, I want to scream at the top of my lungs to anyone who will listen. We need to take action. And yet it is rarely covered in the mainstream media. And I don't know about you, but as citizens, I feel relatively disempowered to make change. Why isn't it at the top of everyone's agenda? I love that Anya has created a unique, creative way, not only for us to consume, but to also engage with the emotive topic. I know that so many of you listening today might have your own business and create amazing products that have a sustainable approach. I know that so many of you work for companies where sustainability is at the top of their agenda. And all I say is, keep going. As long as we are all making mindful decisions about the businesses that we work for, we will make change. Our younger generations will need to think and act creatively and quickly to combat some of the world's biggest inherited issues. You could say that more than ever, the next generation needs to be a society with the most transformative entrepreneurs. One thing we all recognise is the lack of thinking creatively across many industries and many, many sectors. The fact that we need to change old ways, that we have to be visionary. And this is so obvious when it comes to our education system that's not currently structured in a way that allows for diversity of thought or differentiating to individual life choices. Don't get me wrong, the teachers across the UK are doing the most incredible job, but they're forced to operate within a system and a structure that is no longer fit for purpose. So I welcome Kate Robinson, an international consultant in creativity and innovation in education, and the daughter of the transformative thinker, the late Ken Robinson, to share her vision for our education system.
Oh, you know, I was going to say, we call it The Element. So Finding Your Element, which is a book that Dad wrote. And Dad described The Element as the point where natural passion meets personal aptitude. So it's what where
there
we love
go.
To do.
Diamond
is what,
aside, yeah. Ken is here. The Element, that's
the
right.
Element.
So say
yeah.
that again. So it's where so, you're...
It's where personal passion meets natural aptitude, which essentially means it's where what you love to do meets what you're good at. And they're both important because you can be really good at things and not love them. You know, you meet loads of people who've studied piano their whole life and just really kind of can, but would rather not. And then you meet loads of people who really love the piano, but try as they might, just can't quite get a grip on it. And that's not your element in that case, unfortunately. It's something you love to do, but it's not your element. And Dad's contention was that everybody has an element, and it's about finding what that is. And he wrote another book called Finding Your Element with various exercises. And in it, there's, you know, this idea of finding your tribe. So meeting other people who love that too, or who are in the same, which is, you know, something that you do with your small businesses, you know, a small business meeting other small businesses, it that sort of sense of community and camaraderie is huge. You know, it really boosts morale. So the other example Dad gave in The Element was a man called Bart Connor, who was an Olympic gymnast who married Nadia Comaneci. I think I'm pronouncing that right. I could be wrong.
I'm positive you are.
Thank you.
Positive.
She was the first perfect 10 gymnastics. But his mum realised that he could walk upstairs on his hands as well as he could on his feet. And it was a party trick. You know, people would come around and he'd walk up the stairs on his hands. They took him to a gymnastic centre and he said he walked in and it just felt like it was where he was meant to be. You know, everybody was walking on their hands and doing backflips, and he just felt like, you know, whereas Dad said, if you took Dad into a gymnastic centre, I mean, Dad had polio, but if you took him into a gymnastic centre, it's not how he would have felt about it. You know, it would have smelt funny and he would have been scared of heights. But for Bart Connor, he walked in and he just knew that was where he was meant to be. So The Element's got lots of stories of people like that, you know, who often, in spite of their education, found what it was that they truly love. And the case is that actually there are a few reasons why you should find your element. One is because life is short and you only have one chance to live it. And so why would you waste it doing something that isn't the thing that you're meant to be doing, you know, not pursuing your diamond?
Yes.
And the other is that our societies depend on them, like we were talking about. You know, we depend on a diversity of talents and skills and interests to help our cultures flourish. And then, you know, there's a third one, which is being a mentor. Once you've figured out what your element is, going around and helping other people find theirs, you know, because no one really does anything on their own. You know, you do need somebody to hold your hand and get on with it.
Tell me, when you talk about this sort of like finding your element, and then thus that would fuel the diversity that you're talking about, because by very nature, then everyone would be different and doing their different bits to building your analogy, the home. But it's hard, isn't it, for our teachers? As you said,
yes.
You mentioned about COVID and what they've taken on and the challenge now of the children that they've got. And and we're recording on the week that the A-level results are about to come out, right? And I've just heard the statistics and I'm just, oh gosh, I don't want to be a child or parent having to deal with all of that.
No.
It's hard for a teacher to teach from the heart, though. It's hard for a teacher to get that diamond, follow the education system, find the diamond, nourish it, and get your grades at the time. How do we start to address this? Because I heard you speaking about this mandate of the 40-minute lesson.
Yeah.
And then you said the bell rings, and then you all change to another classroom, and you do another subject. And you said something like, you know, if we did that in our jobs, how would we get anything done?
No, like, businesses would grind to a halt and you'd be so angry. You every 40 minutes you had to stop in mid-flow and get up and move somewhere else to a whole new set of people and try and adjust to their energy and swap out, you know, stop thinking what you're thinking about before and start thinking about something new. It's actually not mandated. It's one of those things in the education system that we've always done it that way, so people assume that we have to do it that way. But there's nowhere actually dictated that the school
goodness.
Day has to be set out like that. In the same way, there's no dictate, you know, there's nothing that dictates the way a classroom should look, or that students can't participate, that teachers have to stand in the front of the classroom. There's actually quite a lot of flexibility within the system as it is. It's just we take it so much for granted that it's always been that way. The dad always gave an example of senses. So if you ask somebody how many senses they have, they say five. Holly, I should be able to rattle off our five senses, but I always miss one. God, so bear with me. I'm not going to pick
them. I also thought there were six. So listen, no, so there's we're six, in the six. Same bubble here. We're in the Gatsby bubble.
We are,
okay?
The Gatsby bubble. But the sixth sense is you know, the Haley Joel Osment talking to dead people.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's what? It's taste, smell, sight, sound, and touch. Yes.
Yes.
She did it. but actually, we have at least nine. You know, so we have a sense of temperature. We have a sense of temperature. We have a sense of balance. We have a sense of awareness and space. And they're all genuine. So to be a sense, you have to have an experience in a part of the body related to it. So touch is your tongue, you know, taste is your tongue, and touch is your skin. For balance, it's your inner ear. You know, for temperature, it's the... Why am I blanking on the word here? But it's all the little receptors in the skin that sort of control your body temperature. So they're proper bona fide, not elite, you know, not sort of only a couple of us have them, but proper parts of our human anatomy that are part of the human experience. But because we've been told so many times that we have five senses, we don't really stop to question whether or not that's true. And we couldn't get out of bed without our sense of balance. Yeah. You know, you literally couldn't stand up.
Yes.
It's so important. So when it comes, the same is true, you know, if you take that for granted, we take intelligence for granted as well. We minimize intelligence to academia, which is a way of looking at something as opposed to an actual skill. So you can be academic at anything, you know, but we say academic subjects, but you can have an academic approach to art. You know, you can study art without ever picking up a paintbrush or creating a piece of art. You can study the history of it and the way it works. You know, it's a way of looking at things. And we reduce it to IQ, which I'll say for another time, but it's just absolute nonsense. But because we've always done that, we don't think about the fact that, you know, we also assign creativity to being about certain subjects. Mm. And it's not. Creativity is like academic. It's a way of looking at things. It's a certain skill base that we have that you can apply to absolutely anything and you do on a daily basis. Imagination, we use our imaginations every day. We think of it as being child play. But if you think about what you had for dinner last night, that's your imagination. That's being imaginal. It's ability to bring to mind things that aren't present to your senses. If you think about where you want to go on holiday,
yes,
that's being imaginative. You know, we're constantly using our imaginations. But again, it's that thing of challenging
the norm, the grey, the way it's always been done. Do you think there's also an element of fear?
Yes,
and that we're just more comfortable with conformity and you know, the entrepreneurial spirit is not alive and kicking in any system whatsoever, because no one's trying to mess this up. No one's trying to, and we're going to talk about what you do and things, but generally what I'm saying is that the system is there and it's governed by people who fear to change it.
Well, yeah, because I don't think anybody wants to mess up a generation of children's lives, and it's a big system and it's a human system, so it's, you know, by definition able to change, but it's also difficult to change because there are lives at stake. And you think, well, you know, the system we have isn't perfect, but people graduate and they get on with their lives and everyone you get through it. I got through it. Well, I didn't get through it as it happens, but you know, parents get through it and so their kids will probably get through it too. But actually, when you look at it, people aren't getting through it. You know, you look at the dropout rates, you look at the unemployment rates, you look at the imprisonment rates, you look at the fact that suicide used to be the leading cause of death in middle-aged men. It's now the second leading cause of death in 16 to 24-year-olds.
Gosh, I didn't know.
And various studies by the World Health Organization, have shown a lot of it is, you know, there's various reasons. There's the reasons that we're always there. There's, you know, childhood abuse, but there's also social media is a huge part of it, but there's also a huge amount of exam pressure. Mm. And children in these studies do cite the pressure that they feel they're under to get a certain grade, to go to a certain university, just actually means that, you know, it doesn't feel worth it anymore. So when you look at it, we are actually genuinely ruining people's lives with the system, but because it's in place, you're terrified to change it. And I get it. It is a very difficult beast to change. It's not impossible.
What do you think the next 100 years of education looks like? And do you think change will come?
Yes, I think it has to, and I think it will come. I do think it comes with empowering youth voice. And I do think there will come a point. There's a brilliant book called Schools on Trial by Nikhil Goyal, and he wrote it when he was about 19. And I love it because he's so angry. You know, he's just come out of the system and he's furious he's been put through it. And I think if that's, you know, the revolution at the moment is very polite as far as revolutions go.
Yes.
You know, it's sort of polite campaigning and talking at events and a lot of preaching to the converted. But I do think what we need to start doing is actually...
Less polite,
actually, you know, actually start a revolution with it. And the world is changing so quickly, and we are at a tipping point. You know, as we've come to a certain point in our evolution as a species that we can't continue the way that we have been. And it does start with education, so it has to change. And I don't think it'll be easy or pretty, and I don't think it'll be polite or subtle, but I have every confidence that it will happen. It just has to.
how can people get involved in campaigning for that change in education?
We have a platform that we are setting up that is called the Creative Revolution, that's launching shortly, that will have resources available for people. But in the meantime, there is that bit that Dad talked about, that if you're in the system, you know, you are the system. And that doesn't matter if you're a student, if you're a parent, if you're in any way related to education, you are the system. You know, and for young people, you know, the UN declares that education should be to the fulfillment of the whole child. You know, so don't stand for anything less than that. You know, educate yourself on your rights. You have a lot more than you think you do, actually. And that's, you know, another secret we keep from people. So educate yourself on your rights. If you're a parent, stand up for your children's rights, because you have even more rights than they do. And if you're a teacher, you know, it is incredibly difficult because, as you say, you know, you are within the system. You've, you know, your job, particularly in places like America, your job is linked to this directly to the success of the children in your class and their exam results. But people don't go into teaching because, you know, they want to get rich quick. You know, it's a vocation, yeah, and a calling, and it's a people-based job.
Gosh, what a brilliant mind Kate is, and I can't wait to follow her journey over the coming years. Our young have so much to navigate, not only an education system that operates on a one-size-fits-all model, but also a society where social media infiltrates every element of their world, as Kate mentioned just a moment ago. In the same vein, I often talk of Zoe Kalar, founder of We Are Eight. It's a movement that I feel profoundly aligned with, having seen my own Harry navigate the social media world through his school years. It demands total fearlessness, utter dedication, and a belief in the vision to take on social media and Mark Zuckerberg. But my goodness, that is what she is doing. So I hand over to Zoe, the amazing Zoe, to share her vision of the future of social media.
I look at the technology, and technology should serve us as human beings instead of us being slaves to it. And I always think there's this tendency to think, oh my God, they've built all these brilliant algorithms and they're so brilliant out of Silicon Valley. Well, the truth is they've been serving themselves, and those algorithms, by the way, we studied all the algorithms. They're built just to control what we see and how we feel. So I'm all up for challenging the status quo, and it's not as frightening as what exists today, actually.
Oh, well, I'm so pleased to hear about this, because I think it's genius what you're doing, and I think the world is completely ready. All of us are completely ready for you and what you're building. I'm going to get into it more later down the podcast, but just to kick us off before we get into your childhood, would you just tell us a little bit about We Are Eight, and just more about what we're going to hear about?
Yeah, so Holly, look, this has been, I feel everything I've kind of done for the last 35 years has kind of led to this, but basically, I built a company in the US that was tracking ad spend all around the world, a data company. And the shocking thing, I mean, we were looking at brands spend $500 billion a year. Last year, $117 billion went directly to Facebook. And the crazy thing was, it wasn't even working for the advertisers. Like, the click-through rate and engagement was under 0.4%. So that sort of struck me as, how could we have $117 billion going to a company that's only delivering 0.4% engagement rate? Rio Ferdinand, who's a big partner, and I often laugh, I mean, it's what would Manchester United have said if you'd all go onto the field and you'd only be successful 0.4% of the time? I mean, everyone would be thrown off. So I was looking at this just thinking, this is so broken. It's not even working for advertisers. And then at the same time, we were seeing, you know, the climate. As a mum, as a human, I was seeing that they were fueling climate misinformation. I remember 7 years ago, I was saying, we have 15 years until the damage we've done to our planet is irreversible. I was seeing it fuel the mental health crisis and just how people were feeling. And then there was this catalyst moment for me. I was in the States, and there was a stat that the Federal Reserve came out with saying 40% of all Americans can't find $400 in an emergency. which, by the way, they think post-COVID, it's 80% of all Americans. It's very similar stats here in the UK. I mean, these stats are shocking. And I just thought, oh, my God, each of us is worth $400 a year to Zuckerberg and Facebook. And yet that's what people can't get, you know, people can't find that in an emergency.
Can't get hold of it.
Right. So all we've got to do is have brands now value and pay people for their time instead of going through social. So for us, it was sort of two things. How do we reimagine that ad model so the money is shared? I often see headlines saying VR8 pays users to watch ads. Well, no, we don't. We share the advertiser money with our citizens and charities. 5% of all the money goes through to charities, 5% goes to a creator fund, and 50% of the money goes into people's pockets. We share the wealth, we share the money with the people. And I think it's this reimagine the economic model to redirect the money from the tech companies back to people, and then reimagine social in a way that you can't be anonymous, is free from hate, is good for the planet. So what you're going to see in January is a completely reimagined social that's going to feel like an old familiar shoe, like putting on Instagram, but you'll be back in control. You'll see your friends free of algorithms in a friend's feed. You'll get inspired on the eighth stage by following people you love. And then if you want to watch a couple of ads, every time you do, donations go to charity and money goes into your wallet so you can pay your mobile bill, you can pay your Spotify. Because our whole thinking is you should be getting a pound a day or a dollar a day for 2 to 3 minutes of your time. The tech companies shouldn't get it. And so what starts with a sort of a commercial economic, reclaiming our economic power, then turns into us standing united to all have a voice. So our larger vision is then to just bring power back to people's voices and imagine a world where we can not just 8 million people don't have enough food in the UK. So let's get today, donate your earnings to Fair Share, who can get someone a meal for 25p. Let's address that together. And then let's tap on this petition to save the bees, so that Greenpeace can, you know, go to parliament with or multiple parliaments around the world with a billion signed petitions. It's this whole collective action wrapped in a really fun bow. We look at Facebook and these massive tech behemoths and we cannot imagine any fragility. They have no civic responsibility. They just don't give a shit. They run their own race. They report to shareholders. They want to make more money. They control what we see and how we feel, and they do not care that it causes teen suicide, for God's sake, Holly. I mean, what fucking world are we living in that that's okay? And so that we had to take – there had to be an evolution of that. And what's fascinating, when you build a model that – delivers advertisers a better result but shares the majority of all the money, then you create a much more abundant ecosystem where everything can thrive. I mean, we were looking at so in Australia, I was in Australia last week, we've got a cracking team there, and there's 21 million social media users in Australia. We call people citizens, not users. But we were looking at the stats. If 20 million daily active eight citizens watched just 2 minutes of ads a day, so whether you're waiting for the bus, cleaning your teeth, whatever, just watch 2 minutes of ads a day, in 1 month, $28 million would go to charity, $360 million to the people, $8 million to climate solutions, and $36 million to a creator fund to fund pure creativity, art, music, all of so. And by the way, we take 40 cents in the dollar to cover the tech infrastructure and the security infrastructure and everything that's absolutely fucking massive behind the scenes. But when you build a system that is truly sustainable, which is not just good for the planet, but good for people and good for everyone, where everyone is thriving and it's moving from greed and scarcity and fear to abundance and love, and where we're all thriving, then and that, by the way, is just 20 million people. So imagine that. I mean, our whole mission is 2 billion people making this their social home, feeling safe. No, you can't be anonymous, and zero tolerance of hate, and pay your bills, and let's all do good shit together, can we?
Right now, while you're listening to me, take your phone, pause me maybe, and just go and download We Are 8, the app, and promise me you'll do this. Because what a woman, what a vision. She really is right up there for me in terms of the powerhouse women who I admire. And we need to back women, men, everyone who's looking to make a change for the better. And it's in this podcast, actually, that it allowed me to connect with people like Zoe, with so many of them. And despite being a staunch feminist all my life, it's perhaps only in my 40s that I've truly, deeply understood the phenomenal power of women, not only as individuals, but as a collective. In fact, I'd say it's only really in the last 6 months that it's been transformative for me in understanding and personally feeling the effects of sisterhood. With the launch of Holly & Co's marketplace, I've been out there in the world, doing it all over again, connecting, saying yes to invitations, and saying absolutely to connecting over coffee, and yes to new introductions from others. It's not that I didn't want to do this before, it was that I'm just so knee-deep, head down in building. But I do now profoundly understand the power of the female network, of creating the corridors of power within the sisterhood rather than the hallways of governments and most industries and most golf courses that have been eternally full of men. One of the things I'm most proud of at Holly & Co. is the fact that over 90% of the small businesses that sell on our marketplace are female founded. It means that every time you shop with us, you are voting with your money for the kind of world you want to live in. By supporting women-owned businesses, you're backing the idea of flexible working, showing the next generation what's possible, and actively championing the female economy. It means that despite only 2 pence of every pound of venture capital funding in the UK going to women, and women still being the primary caregivers, we collectively at Holly & Co. are rising above and finding a new way to live, our way. You can support female-founded businesses by looking out for the badges on our website. In fact, we have lots of ways to shop by your values, from choosing black-owned businesses or socially positive businesses to products that are made of recycled material or made here in the UK. Find out more at holly.co. For now, let's get back to our very special 200th episode. So what does the future look like for women, and how can we all ensure that women have a seat at the table? Who better to ask than Edwina Dunn, founder of Dunnhumby, a name you might not be familiar with and yet will have most definitely been engaging with, the pioneer of the loyalty card and customer data, her first major creation being the Tesco Club Card, that small thing.
We need role models, you know, and I really believe that you can't be what you can't see. And so, you know, the whole of, you know, the campaign that I run now, the Female Lead, is all about making visible women who are alive today, shaping the world around them. So many women doing amazing things, but we're just not captured in the history books. So I think the more we can identify with someone, you know, it may not be just one person. We might pick a little bit of this person and a little bit of that. But what we create is a composite, which is it's like a You know, like you'd have a mood board when you're designing, you know, your new house or some clothes or something that you were making and wanted to wear. Well, you know, we have a mood board for our role models. Mm. We have the idea that they should be this and they should have that. And when you have that, I believe it's so much easier to develop those traits and those skills. So I think as women, we really, you ask a boy who his heroes are, who his role models are, he will list 5 to 10 people straight off, most of them sports people, but not exclusively. Girls, it will be their mother or their grandmother, maybe their teacher. That's it. The truth is, women are massive. They may not earn all the income for a household, but actually they spend most of the income. So women are decision makers. And I think a lot of that is about survival. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got the cost of living crisis. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it is about how do I make my pounds go further? I like to say women make the pound go round.
That is good.
Do you like that?
It's good. I will always use your name when I will say she said it here. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Well, women, they manage that very difficult, you know, housekeeping process. But, you know, at the same time, they will make big decisions. It's not all the little decisions. They will, you know, they will probably decide which car mm-hmm. the family ends up buying. They will probably decide which mortgage supplier mm-hmm. or certainly which house is or flat or whatever is going
where
to be.
Where they're going to go on holiday.
Exactly. So women make at least 70% of all buying decisions.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I've said is that, you know, we have a name for a lot of expenditure. So, for example, the pink pound is the LGBTQ plus community, right? The black pound is the black community. Mm-hmm. The purple pound is the disability. So we have all these different pounds. There is nothing.
I mean,
for the female pound, right? So I've called it.
Go on.
The invisible pound.
Yeah.
Because women are invisible. Yeah. Caroline Criado Perez talks about this very eloquently.
Right, yes, I've got her book right here. And she was a guest on my podcast when the book came out.
Very, very good writer. So she talks about this. So I said, well, it's the invisible pound. Women are 51% of the population. We make 70% plus of all buying decisions.
And yet we're invisible.
Exactly. There you go. When I grew up, there were no women that you could see who were high achievers other than your mother or your grandmother. And so, you know, my first job was to get role models into schools. Mm-hmm. So I've now gifted 25,000 books to schools around the world to say, look, here are living, breathing, amazing women that you might want to learn about. And, you know, before then, it was Florence Nightingale and Ada Lovelace. And it's like, they're old and dead. They're very good, but they're old and dead. So, and then I thought, job done. What I noticed was that working women were saying, we're not seen, we're not heard. And that's why I stayed with the project. And during lockdown, Holly, what was so moving was that our following, as we posted these hopefully uplifting, positive elements on our social media, our following went crazy. We just exponential growth. So we, through COVID, women needed somewhere to be heard, to have some old-fashioned word, sucker, right?
Mm-hmm.
We now have about 8.5 million followers. So, you know, women have stayed with us. And for me, the opportunity I now have is to make those voices something that leaders and governments can't ignore. And that's my mission. which is to say it how it is, to represent all women, every age, every stage, but to say this is what we feel and this is what we need, and not to be broken up into little factions, which are legitimate. But, you know, we don't just want to be about menopause. We don't just want to be about safety.
Yeah.
We want to be women who are seen and heard for our entire journey and not made invisible, for example, after the age of 30. My thesis is that if we show that we can get economic growth, that we can do a Tesco, help organizations double their market share by understanding women better. And then, by the way, probably bringing them into the organization so that women can buy from women. If we can do that, we can change a lot. Because I think, sadly, we are, well, realistically, maybe driven a lot by financial return. So let's make it a financial return. Women are a good investment.
Proof in the pudding.
Absolutely. So that's my thesis. That's what I'm working towards.
Right.
I'm going to give it my best shot.
So the future of equality rests in our hands. It rests in raising one another up, giving other women not only a seat at the table, but ensuring that you, as a woman, are visible for others to see and emulate. It will take some guts to do, and if I'm honest, a lot of internal rewiring. But my goodness, I'm ready to take it on. Are you? Dell Technologies are passionate champions of small businesses. They recognise that it can be a lonely road, and so they have the Dell Women's Entrepreneur Network, or DWEN for short, which is a worldwide community of over 100,000 female founders. They run free events and mentoring programmes and have a network of brilliant women all connecting and sharing insight. They also recognise that for many small businesses, visibility is one of the biggest challenges they face when trying to reach new customers. So each week, Dell give away their ad break space. So now I'm going to hand over to this week's winner of Dell's independent ad break.
I'm Chloe, founder of Chloe Hayward London. I'm a small, sustainable business of 15 years using waste textiles and making them into colourful, beautiful fashion accessories and homeware. I'm also a stylist, a mentor, and I even have my own radio show, Sustainable Stories. I'm obsessed by finding a use for the pre-loved and unloved, and I love the stories behind the textiles I've sourced, and obsessed by the journey that they'll continue to have. Join me on my rich tapestry of discoverings on Instagram, Chloe_Hayward_London. Or you can find out more and read more in my blog at ChloeHaywardLondon.com.
Thank you, Dell, for your support and generosity. If you'd like to find out more about DWEN and connect with brilliant and inspiring women, or you'd like to be in with a chance to have your very own ad break here on this series, head to holly.co/Dell. Now, back to this week's conversation of inspiration. Another area important to us all, alongside women and small businesses and the environment and society and everything in between, is the independent high street. So I hand over to Mark Shaler, an utterly fascinating man. And through the course of his conversation, we tackle everything from how to unleash creativity to education and how then big businesses should emulate small. But I wanted to share here his viewpoint on how we could seek to rejuvenate the high street and reclaim our heritage.
We can't rely on government. I mean, no disrespect to any government, but their policy and their using knowledge from a long time ago to apply to a future that has not been invented yet. They're trying to use recipes from the past for future cooking, and that isn't going to work. We need to look tangentially. We need to look at those areas that have boomed, those areas that have done really well, and say, well, what were the magic ingredients here? And we need the Susans and we need the Altafs to get involved, and we need to be able to kind of grow from the bottom up rather than from the top down. A new shopping centre will not solve your problems. Mm. Amazing local entrepreneurs selling products that people want and need and that are less damaging, that's what's going to save your town. Making it fun to come into town
so
for more than one reason, that's the magic. And then if we can build that into, rather than have travel agents and who are great and solicitors who are amazing, but rather than have retail space full up of that, let's make space for these incredible local artists. Let's make space for this person that's making bread on a Saturday and giving it away to their mates, or the would-be sauce entrepreneur. Let's make space. Let's create a hub for these people. Mm. Let's allow them to lift off and charge them next to no rent. Because that's the only way that we're going to get the town centres back. That always creates a problem in terms of income and in terms of yield. I appreciate that. I would rather see taxation spent doing that than taxation spent in a million other ways that it's currently spent.
Yeah.
So placing personality at the heart of entrepreneurship, placing purpose at the heart of entrepreneurship, making sure each town looks different. Do you remember when you could tell what town you were in just from walking around rather than
clone towns versus hometowns?
There you go. I grew up near Leicester, so I used to walk around Leicester. It was quite clearly Leicester. Silver Arcade had great shops in there. You had Wellgosh in there. You had the Wardrobe in there. It was quite clearly Leicester. Down the road, you've got Limey's, quite clearly Leicester. If I go to the High Cross Centre now, could be in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
Could be anywhere. And we've lost diversity in every possible way. And we've lost the feeling and the texture, the velvety texture of place.
Mm.
And I think we need to work on how we bring that back. So I see huge positivity for towns and cities, but we're never going to solve it by looking at the things that solved it in the past, which was a new shopping centre, which was knocking stuff down but keeping the facades and putting an Apple store in. Amazing, great, but that is not the answer.
No.
It's part of the mix.
As we come to the end of this very special episode, I had the very hard task of working out who the final guests would be. I have 199 to choose from, and each one holds a very special place in my heart. From Richard Reed, founder of Innocent, and the tears during his letter, to my extremely nervous first podcast with Julie Dean, founder of Cambridge Satchel Company, to the interview where I had to go entirely off script with the music god Goldie, and welcoming Joe Wicks into our old deli for some broccoli on toast for an in-person record. I've had newfound friendships created with the likes of Fern, Trini and Charlie Gladstone, to name just a tiny few. I've spoken to my heroines and heroes of business, Bobby Brown, Dame Anya Hindmarsh and Sir Tim Smith. Heard the quiet storytelling of Lord Billimoria, founder of Cobra Beer, Shamil Thakra of Dishoom and the one and only Chrissy Rucker, founder of The White Company. Oh, the list genuinely is endless. I also wanted to take a quick moment to say thank you to those who work behind the scenes. As you can imagine, there is a lot that goes into making these episodes, from booking guests to scripts to edits. The list is as well endless. So thank you, team. And a special shout out goes to Gabby, where it all began, to Harriet, who keeps the ship sailing, to Petrula, who makes sure that my research is absolutely phenomenal, and to my sound editor, Steve. I'm just so grateful for all of you, for the team conversations of inspiration. So on that note, for my final guest, it has felt right that if these founders had the power, then we would prioritise a perspective of living in gratitude and happiness. We'd understand that encouraging people to do what they love and love what they do not only would be amazing for the economy, but would also help the mental health crisis we find ourselves in. So I hand over to the thought leader in happiness, Mo Gordit.
I was not always happy, if you want. At age 29, I started to become extremely successful. I was literally almost printing money on demand. And I was miserable. I was as depressed as you can be. And, you know, I struggled to find my happiness. And I did a bit of research here and a bit of research there. Couldn't find my way until I was listening to a song by Supertramp. If you remember the band, then you're too old. So anyway, so Supertramp is a British band that had a song that was very interesting called the Logical Song. And it starts with, when I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful. It basically talks about how we're happy as children. And then they send me away to teach me how to be logical, responsible, practical, cynical, critical, and so on. And the song, basically, I was listening to it in a coffee shop in Seattle, Washington, I remember vividly. And I literally put my phone down, or at the time it was an iPod. I put my iPod down and I said, that's it. That's the answer. I was always happy. I was born happy. Mm-hmm. And until I started to change something about me when my kids were born and I decided to provide for them and I engaged in life so dedicatedly, until that moment, I was always happy. And if you go back in time, and you know, all you really need is a 4-minute research on YouTube, really, to look for any infant, every infant that's ever been born, if they're fed and safe and given their basic needs for survival, their state is happy. It's our innate state. It's our default setting, as I call it. And we walk out of that state into unhappiness. It's not the other way around. The world is trying to convince us that we're unhappy until we fulfill ourselves with something, or, you know, some material possession, or some ego gratification, or some party. That's not true at all. We are happy inside, and then things make us unhappy, like a child. When a diaper gets wet, the child feels unhappy and cries. And then when you change the diaper, the child goes back to happiness. It's as simple as that. It truly is our default state. At a point in time, I started to tell myself, okay, I understand that babies are born happy. It's our default state. I understand that happiness is the absence of unhappiness, that we need to remove unhappiness to find happiness. So instead of me trying to list down every moment in my life that I felt unhappy and basically try to work on them one by one, I did what we used to do when we coded software. Okay, I said, is there an algorithm that you can input into a computer and then run that algorithm and it will find for you every moment that you felt unhappy based on input that made you unhappy? The idea was, there must be an algorithm. There must be something that's repetitive. It cannot be that random, because most of us humans seem to feel unhappy the same way. So it's probably triggered by the same things. And yeah, I looked at all of the moments in my life where I felt happy at the time, or at many of the moments, and I tried to find the common theme between them. And the common theme is actually very easy when you understand it. It's not about what's happening in your life at that moment. Mm-hmm. Okay. It is about how you want life to be in comparison to what is happening. So if I and you are recording this conversation, and I expect that this conversation will take no less than an hour, and you expect this conversation to take no more than an hour, okay? One of us is bound to be disappointed. One of us is going to come out of this conversation feeling disappointed. It doesn't really matter how long the conversation was, okay? But if your expectation is less than an hour and my expectation is more than an hour, and it lasts for an hour and 10 minutes, I'm happy, you're unhappy.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's as simple as that. The length of the conversation has nothing to do. There is no inherent happiness in an hour, 10 minutes. It's a comparison between the actual reality of your life, or at least your perception of the reality of your life, and how life should be. Okay. Now, in our brains, again, like a geek, it's estimated that we can do up to 60,000 transactions a day. So you can actually look at the world around you, almost like the clock of a computer, you know, the megahertz. You can look around you and make a quick calculation up to 60,000 times a day. Now, in each of those calculations, in many of them, your brain, being a survival machine, has only one objective, which is to compare the life that you're living to how it perceives life to be safe.
Right.
Okay. And if life falls short of what your brain perceives to be safe, it alerts you in the form of an emotion. And that emotion could be shame, could be regret, could be fear, could be worry, anxiety, whatever it is, a negative emotion that corresponds to unhappiness. Now, if it looks around it and finds that life seems to be okay, it does what it's biologically supposed to do, which is to allow your body to rest, digest, and maybe sleep by telling you, hey, I scanned the world around me and there is nothing wrong. You can close your eyes. It's fine. Okay? Now, that behavior, life misses expectations, I'm going to alert you. Mm-hmm. Life meets expectations, I'm going to leave you alone so that you can rest and relax, can be summarized in a very simple equation. And the equation is your happiness is equal to or greater than the difference between the events of your life and your expectations of how life should be. Okay? Every event that happens, you compare. If it falls short, you're unhappy. If it meets or beats, you feel happy. And it's as simple as that, bulletproof, every single time.
I mean, it sounds simple, doesn't it? Happiness is the difference between expectation and reality. And yet it has profoundly impacted the way I've looked at the future since this conversation that I recorded. It has permeated my day to day and shapes how I look ahead to my future. How does my expectation match with my reality? How can they be in line with each other? Because it is there that true happiness will always lay. Right, as ever, this is the part at which I hand over to my guest to read a letter to their younger self. And we simply couldn't agree within the team, and so we landed on these two. So I'm delighted to hand over to Mark Constantine, the founder of Lush, reading live in Manchester Cathedral. I'm so pleased, team, we did pick this one. It's poignant, perhaps, because it perfectly summarises so many of the lessons we've learnt over the past 199 episodes, the vital importance of business making a positive impact, having purpose, navigating some of life's greatest lows, the greatest highs, creativity, and the power of connection, and above all, love.
I'm writing to myself, age 16, 17, when I was homeless. Hello, Mark. Here are a few choice words of advice at what is a pretty bad time for you. You will not always live like this. You will find a home, a lovely one, with Mo and plenty of children. But homelessness will give you empathy for those in similar situations and drive you to be successful. On that note, keep on with the makeup and hair studies. They will come in very handy. In the early part of your career, make the most of your time with Anita. Don't be frightened of her and pay a bit more attention to what she's up to. You are going to love what she gets you into, and you have so much to learn, both from her and Gordon. You are going into business like your nan, shops, beauty shops to be precise, and you're going to have a hell of a good time. There will be ups and downs, but you will come through both and you won't die in the effort. Can I just say that you don't die young of a heart attack? Or at all. That panicky fear thing is just you grieving for your nan. And it's doing her proud, not impressing your dad, that will drive you on. I don't want to spoil what you will later discover, but here are a few clues. You aren't from Cyprus, but from here in Manchester. Bolton, to be precise. Your gran and granddad live here, and your auntie June. They would love to see you. Your dad's in Britain, by the way, but just off to South Africa with your lovely stepmum and two sweet sisters. Don't worry about that, though, because you will, in the end, come together. Don't try to go with him. He gets caught up in developing the nuclear bomb for South Africa and Israel, and you've got a different path to take. Your thoughts about the environment are right. Stick with them. I don't really have to tell you this, but you will never learn to drive and will still be riding your bike when you're 70. Oh, yes. And did I mention that the years from 55 to 75 are the most creative years of your life? Which are, I have to add, going to be a bit busy. The most surprising thing you will learn is how much your senses will mean to you. I suppose it comes from the period of homelessness. Nobody and nothing can take your senses away, not even age. And the synesthesia turns out to be a gift. Make the most of your love of music and birdsong. Keep smelling the roses and never forget the tenderness of touch. Your love of nature will also blossom into 100 different pieces, and you will write that book, but it won't be about what you think. There will be quite a few run-ins for you, mainly with the men in your life. Some are great, like Jeffrey Osmond, Peter Grant, and Killian Mulaney, and they will enhance your appreciation of the world. I could warn you about a few of the others, but where's the fun in that? As a rule of thumb, trust your gut instincts and continue to believe in the wisdom of women, and you will sort the wheat from the chaff. Just one little clue, that mint mask for men you just brought from Sally, the holiday magic girl, is going to make you a lot of money. No, don't start selling holiday magic, just wait. The friends you make when you first start in business will remain friends and colleagues for the rest of your life. Like attracts like. You will be able to trust each other with your lives. As you get older, the same happens with your family, which just keeps growing. Oh, and Sister Laura will sort your mum out, and you will all live happily ever after. Finally, carry on trusting people. Never lose that trust. And as you get older, spend plenty of time with younger folk. They have so much to teach you. Love, Mark.
And the second letter, I somewhat resisted, I have to say, but the team insisted. It was my letter from my 100th episode, and it is without a doubt the most raw and open I think I've ever been, and so perhaps it's fitting to go right here. Dearest Holly, I have been asked by you, actually, to write a letter to your younger self. You know, it's been coming for some time, and for some reason, you've felt quite all over the place about what to say. Not because I think you will ignore the advice, even though headstrong, I know even a sniff of being able to move you faster in the right direction, you'll grab the chance if you think you can get a head start. But I'm not going to give you the winning lottery numbers or a secret to greatness or anything like that. But what I will tell you, believe me, will make you far richer in so many ways. You see, because I am you, this is the first time anyone will talk to you about your total lack of self-love. I know no one knows this, and no one sort of ever will. Your secret is safe with me. But I, your future self, I have to tell you something. Are you listening to me? You need to hear this, my darling girl. You are enough. Don't shake your head. Don't cry. You're safe with me. But it's true. Why do you feel you are so invisible? Why do you know you sort of should be, that you deserve to be? I know everyone on the outside sees this happy-go-lucky teen. But let's face it. Those thoughts before you fall asleep are not great. The pressure you put yourself under, feeling you're so not pretty, so not clever, so not worthy, they make you feel so very sad. You cry yourself to sleep over those who you're picking to be in your life, who just make you feel even worse about yourself. You do not deserve this, my sweet Holly. Now I want you to imagine you and I right now. I am kneeling in front of you and you in front of me. I am cupping your beautiful face with both my hands. I am stroking your cheek with my thumb, catching your tears. Are you listening? Holly, my sweet soul, you are one of the loveliest human beings I know. I know how much you care about what everyone thinks about you. But I promise you, and remember I know, they all love you. They are not thinking any of those terrible things. Holly, my darling, you are so beautiful. And anything that you think now, know you will look back at yourself and almost see sunbeams coming out of every picture. You light up all the memories we have. Your lovely smile, your lovely eyes, they will take you everywhere. Holly, you are perfectly smart, and better still, guess what? You are far from average. You know why? You were born with a superpower. Yes, you. Your sensitivity that some tease you about and make you feel so weak for having,
Well, it's a strength that will have the most astounding effect on your life. Your sensitivity, your emotional intelligence, your empathy, your love of people and their feelings, it is the greatest gift. I will not tell you what happens, but just know that the little notebook you have of ideas about businesses, well, let's just say that one day your wish comes true and it's all down to being extraordinary. I'm now stroking your hair and allowing you to nestle under my arm as I lean my head on yours, squeezing you so tightly as I kiss your head. Dear Holly, you are nothing like anything you think, and these thoughts, far from protecting you or protecting you from the hurt you think you will experience for some reason, they will bring you nothing useful. You will settle into a relationship that you hold on to, even though terrible for you, because you do not feel worthy. You think you better accept it all because no one will ever want you. You are lucky that someone does. You put up with all this pain because you have convinced yourself that you should have nothing better. You will get yourself into a total pickle, as Granny would say. You will disrespect yourself because you think that life is against you. So I wanted to use this time to tell you that the one thing you need to do for me is to love yourself. Start to retrain that wonderful brain right now, as you have no time to lose. Remember what we're like, in such a hurry. So time is of the essence. I need you to take this letter with you always, fold it up and put it in your inside blazer pocket with your copper gloss lipstick. I want you to promise me that you will read it every day. I love you, dear Holly. I love you very, very much. And I promise you that others love you too. I am now 43 years old and you actually feel you could burst. You feel so much love. I'm now lifting you up, holding your shoulders, and I'm looking into your eyes. Look at me. Lift your head, my darling girl. Take a deep breath. Take my advice and just know that everything you dream of will come true. Why? Because amazing things happen to wonderful people, and that's you, my dearest Holly. Now off you go. Walk strong and walk proud. Know I love you very, very much, and you are so much, much more than enough. Love me. I leave you now for today, but before I do, I actually want to say a very huge thank you to you, the wonderful listener who's listening right now. I know we've never met, and actually I know I've met many of you, but there's lots of you who I haven't. But I do feel like we are all connected in some strange way, albeit through just this podcast. Thank you for your support. I know your time is precious, and the fact that you have joined me time and time again throughout all of these interviews and with me today means so much. Without you, this podcast simply wouldn't exist. So here's to our future. Whatever party the country votes in, let us never forget these founders' voices, this podcast, and this library of wisdom. This is the party I vote for. So for now, I send you all my love and I will speak to you soon. Thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, can I ask that you share it with a friend and like, subscribe and review it too, so that together we can inspire even more people to follow their dreams to build a life they love.